Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Chelsea Bond with Let's Talk.
This is Chelsea Bond with Let's Talk. Good morning. Thank you for tuning in this morning. I'd like to first acknowledge the Turrbal and Yuggera people and acknowledge the traditional owners in the land in which you're listening from. I also would like to acknowledge a very special Jagera woman who has been on our TV screens this week. Today's show, we're talking about the Struggle Street, the show on SBS that screened this week and has caused a lot of conversation in our community and more broadly. And here to discuss the show, I have my sister. I don't have Angelina this morning. It's not wild black woman, but I do have a woman who I think is pretty wild and black. Kind of fits the criteria. What's your name? I got to call you Carly or CJ?
Up to you.
Which way? I think of you as CJ all the time.
We'll go with that.
We'll go CJ. We've got CJ this morning.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. How you been?
Yeah, not too bad. Travelling around and seeing this beautiful country of ours, but back in Brisbane now, so thought I'd watch the show last night and keen to come in and have yarn.
So we want to talk about the show, about the response to the show, about some of the discussion that's being had. That NITV's The Point did a very special panel show, which was great to see last night, a more in-depth discussion with Norma, her family, and also some Manala mob as well, to kind of give a more complex understanding of the story, which was good to see. I've also watched on Twitter, I've been reading some of the op-eds, and so we've got a lot to talk about. Mm. And there's also been some interesting reporting on Indigenous affairs more generally that we might yarn about too.
Yeah, sounds good.
But first up, you watched the show. What were your thoughts?
You know what? I'm a sucker for like reality show in general. I really, last year's Struggle Street, was it last year or the year before?
Yeah, I think last year.
I really liked it. I liked seeing, I love real people's stories. And not always like your Kardashians. They're not real. You know what I mean? Like these people are actually real and it makes you sorry. You know what I mean? It hits you like, that's the whole point of the show, really, is to get empathy and to make you feel other things. But, like, for me, I love being able to see everyday people, their stories, you know, and just a lot of it that comes from it, like watching The Point last night and seeing Dr. Chris Sara saying, you know, what I see is hope, what I see is, you know, all of these things. So I really love that stuff as well, and that's the things that I pull out of the show, you know, is like that resilience. And because I've been broke. I've lived in public housing. Yeah, I don't live there anymore, and I feel real deadly now because I'm like, yes, I'm out of that. But at the same time, I could be back there anytime. You know what I mean? Like any of our mob. And if you come from those humble beginnings and you've been through that stuff, like I think it hits you even more. I really love it. Of course, there's parts of it that make you wild or it makes you like, oh, and you don't know who to be angry at, you know. You're like, am I angry at the system? Am I angry at like the people that are filming? Am I angry at, you know, the situation? Like you just, it evokes so much emotion. Yeah. So I really enjoyed it last year. This year's series I find a lot different compared to last year's. I find like I know there was a lot of controversy from the first season, so whether or not they've thought about that and gone, all right, do we do this a bit differently? Do we do it the same? I find the story's a lot closer to home, obviously, in Brisbane.
Literally,
just close to home, and then seeing mob like that you're seeing on the TV, you're like, hey, I know that place, or I know, you know, so. Yeah. And it's so familiar.
Them shoes.
Them shoes. That walk. That. You know? So I'm really enjoying it. And it's still obviously going. There's still parts of it. But I'm enjoying it so far, to be honest. I'm enjoying it, but also same time, like, really torn, you know. Yeah. Like, a bit of sadness, a bit of, like, I don't know. That's the whole point of the show, I guess.
Yeah. So for our listeners who haven't caught Struggle Street, I don't know where you've been, but there's certainly been a lot of talk over the last year when the first season of Struggle Street featured around individuals at Mount Druitt. And their mob down there got wild about the representation of Mount Druitt. And so I understand the production team took on board some of the feedback, the critique, and there were some really confronting images in that first series. And I'm the same with you. I'm not sure enjoyed watching it, but I watched it because it was relatable. Like, I know some of these characters. It's not. I was kind of torn between my annoyance at the response.
Yeah.
So in season one, I mean, there were some really confronting images, you know, of, and what was interesting for me was that there, on the one hand, you had people who were shocked because they'd never seen this before and were going, oh, my goodness, we need to see this because we had no idea. And so I'm kind of angry at them ones for, like, how do you not know? This is our country. This is your people. Not these were black fellas. These were their own mob, you know. So I was a bit, like, annoyed at the divide in this country that we'd have to watch it on TV to understand poverty in this country.
Yeah. When it's walking down the street or it's living next door to you every day.
Live in our neighbourhood and you can understand poverty. And why do people not understand it? And, you know, that says something about this country. On the other side, what really made me wild about season one was not the show, not the story, but the response to it from viewers. And it was violent. You know, the stuff that they were saying, and they weren't talking about black fellas, they were talking about white fellas on the show.
Yeah.
And I found it really offensive the way in which these are human beings.
That's right, yeah.
And in on TV in a vulnerable state.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had that experience of sharing our own family's journey recently this year and the vulnerability of dealing with mental illness and all that kind of challenge. And fortunately, we had a really great response to sharing that story. But, and I was conscious that we could cop a whole lot of other nonsense with it and how that would affect the well-being of our family unit. Mm-hmm. And so when I was reading some of the stuff from last year on social media, the way in which people were talked about, it was really nasty. And I was concerned about how do we protect our mob who, you know, and I'm claiming our mob, like all of them fellas, who are sharing their story at a vulnerable time. And even for some of them, the ability to consent to participate is problematic.
Yeah.
Because if I was a researcher, I'm not sure I could get informed consent to participate.
You're thinking, especially in season one, you know, they were tackling ICE issues, homelessness, you know, a lot of these mob were just cruising around the streets, you know, and then they've got a producer saying, you know, do you want to do this? And like you said, vulnerability and probably not always in the right state of mind as well to be consenting to something like that, but
and forever being out there. So you know when you get clean or you get into that's always there. And so my concern was not about, you know, making the suburb look bad, but really about how do we protect people who are vulnerable in having their stories told in a respectful way, but protecting them from the backlash. Because remember when there was that Q&A episode and it was at Duncan Storer, the fellow asked a question.
Yes. Yeah.
And he got vilified
hard.
And that affected his, you know, and so do we think we have a responsibility? As a researcher, I have a responsibility to not inflict harm, and we have to meet all these rules and requirements when we're interviewing people with vulnerable populations, not even being publicly broadcast, but interviewing people anonymously. We have to really think through the ethics of that and how we protect people.
Yeah.
And I wonder sometimes when we're doing this stuff in the media how we're really thinking about, we might be thinking about the entertainment value.
Yeah. But not the human aspect behind it.
And the long-term effect. There was an interesting one. Did you see, I think it was the episode, that was screened on the first episode, and there was a fella who was trying to get to his mother's funeral.
Oh, mate, me and my brother, I looked at my brother, Sydney, he's 20 years old. I looked over to my brother and he was like tearing up, you know. It's like that moment is just... There's not, like, my mum has passed away. She passed away 7 years ago. And I can tell you there's nothing worse than losing a parent and having to go to their funeral and just the type of day that is in general. And then you've got this fellow who's got, you know, he used to be on, what was it, heroin, he said. You know, his house is just an absolute mess. His family hate him. And then you've got this camera crew. I couldn't think of anything worse, you know. Obviously he had his reasons to share that.
Yeah.
But in that moment, I kind of thought, like, this mob, give this fella a lift.
Hey, just take him.
Take him. He's there waiting for the bus to go to his mother's funeral. Take him. Why can't you take the lad, you know? Like, that's the type of you know, coming from also working in television, I know the type of back stuff that happens to TV production and, you know, the thought process into different shows. But then when does the human element come into things with producers or with cameramen? Like, put the camera down or, like, put it to the side. So, bro, just get in the car. You know?
Don't have
like,
to make this a story because you've already got the story.
That's the story. You don't, like...
Just get in there. I saw a few people getting wild when that was happening, going, just take him. Get him.
Just
get in there.
Take him, yeah.
Because, and there was sort of like, I think there was an article they talked about not wanting to interfere, you know, and there's the, what's it, breaking through the fourth thing or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, the presence of the camera crew would have caused extra stuff for him going on during that time.
Yeah.
So already it's interfering with his life.
Yes.
So why not help?
It's just, I think as a, I'm playing devil's advocate a lot, you know, and I go, as a human and as a person, I'd be like, look, get in the car.
Mm.
And I can see as a cameraman or as a producer, they're sitting there going, oh, this is the moment. Like, oh, if we just let him sit a little bit longer, we just got our audience is just going to froth over this and they're just going to love what it. That's the type of mentality that, you know, television stations have is just that, you know, getting to the point of seeing the vulnerability and breaking through that moment. That's a TV moment, you know?
Yeah.
And it can work. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of shows that you live for that kind of stuff when you work in TV, you know, and news and all the rest of it.
Because it's entertainment.
It's entertainment. But as a human, it's like, how do you sit there and watch this fellow wait for a bus for his mum's funeral? Like, it's just, yeah, he made me proper sorry, that fella.
Hey. Look, we're going to take a little quick break and I'm going to talk more about Struggle Street.
Down city streets, I would roam. I had no bed, I had no home. Crawled out of bushes early morn. Used newspapers to keep me warm. Then I'd have to score a drink, start me up, help me to think. Down city streets I would roam, use my fingers as a comb. In those days when I was young, drinking and fighting was no fun. It was daily living for me. I had no choice, it was meant to be. Down city streets I would run. I had no home. There was nothing that I owned. Used my fingers as a comb. Now I'm a man, I'm not alone. I am married, I have children of my own. Now I have something I call my own. These are my children, and this is my home. I look around and understand how street kids feel when they're put down. Down city streets I would roam. I had no bed, I had no home.
This is Chelsea Bond with Let's Talk. We're live this morning and I've got my sister CJ from CJ's Vines, and we're talking about the latest offering from SBS Season 2 of Struggle Street, which has been on our TV the last few nights and again will be next Tuesday and Wednesday night. If you've missed them, you can catch them on SBS On Demand. And, of course, NITV's The Point did a special panel discussion last night, which is I recommend worth catching, also on demand. Now, CJ, when we're talking about Struggle Street, I wanted to sort of have a look at some of the responses to Struggle Street. And I want to play you a little grab from Channel 9. They came out to the hood to find out about the response.
No, they didn't. Yeah. They didn't come out.
You know, Channel 9 comes out to an aisle all the time, cover the big stories. Bless them. I'll play this one here.
In its own words, Struggle Street says it focuses on inequity and hardship.
The powers that be, they need a ghetto in every major city, and the Nala's it.
This time, Struggle Street is Inala.
Near 20% unemployment blights the postcode area 4077.
In the new episode, single mum Norma Boyd is to be evicted from her government-owned Inala home after her daughter is convicted of a drug offence.
They want you out.
That manhandled me. This is what it takes to remove me from my house. They've taken everything from me.
Inala youth services worker Lisa Tittle knows Inala and watched Struggle Street last night.
Anyone who watched that show, what impression would they have got of Inala, do you think?
Probably a bad rep, really.
Out on the streets of so-called Struggle Street, they didn't like what they'd seen.
I think it's it harms us. It harms us. It harms all these shops. It harms everybody in Inala.
Lovely place. Yeah, lovely place to live.
Prominent critics of Struggle Street, like Lord Mayor Graham Quirk, argue the program singles out and stigmatises individual communities unfairly.
Well, I think it's reputationally damaging. That's why I haven't cooperated with Struggle Street.
A fine line, an exquisite dilemma, highlighting hardship but reinforcing negative perceptions. In any case, some say Struggle Street has no home address.
It's pretty much everywhere, not just Inala.
Do you think Inala should be focused on by Struggle Street?
No, I think Woodridge should be.
For Wellington, Nine News.
Good job, Paul Woodridge,
leave
come
Woodridge
on.
Alone. Come on now. Bless them. Shout out to Woodridge.
Hey.
Don't.
Hey, we're not. Yeah, no.
Some of the best feeds there in Woodridge.
Oh,
true,
goodness. Like it,
oh,
yeah.
Man. You know what's really interesting about that I pulled out of that was, you know.
You mean what's an exquisite dilemma about that?
Reinforcing negative stereotypes. Is it a stereotype or is it truth? I get a lot of that stuff with CJ's Vines. Oh, you're reinforcing negative stereotypes about our mob or our black women are violent or all these things. Well, we're not. It's just what it is. Good ways. You know, like my the things I do on CJ's Vines, a lot of it's a reflection of my life and a lot of things around us. And this show here as well is a reflection of what's going on in Inala, but also a lot of places, lot of people said. And it's a stain for Australia, you know what I mean? For mainstream Australia that are living their life, have never grown up with trauma, who have never grown up with any type of social issue before, oh, that's a dirty thing. Like, why is that? You all need to clean up your act. You know, this high horse that people sit on, you know, poverty can happen to anybody.
What made me wild about that clip and the comments around that was the misdirected outrage.
Mm.
So the outrage was all about the shops and our suburb and how it makes us look. And just go to Woodridge instead of here. No. But there wasn't the outrage about kids being made homeless and being evicted out of housing commission with 20-something
poppers. Exactly.
Not outraged about, because those kids saw that.
Yeah.
They lived that.
And they will live that forever.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's no outrage about that.
And you know, and they spoke really powerfully on the point last night and talking about their experience. And people have no idea that black kids' encounters with police start very early on, and they're these kinds of encounters.
Yeah. My brother hates police. He's had that same negative stereotype over and over since he was 13. And, you know, we're not a perfect family, but we're pretty good, you know. I've tried to raise him after our mum passed away with some, you know, being a black man, and it's really hard no matter what type of home you come from, whether it's a good one or a bad one, that our black kids get negatively stereotyped a lot. And that's something that happens. That's not a stereotype. That's not a misconception.
No,
I know, because it's in my house.
We've got kids that from Inala who get on a bus at Oxley and, you know, are constantly questioned by police while waiting for the bus to go to a private school in their private school uniforms, because their bodies are read in a particular kind of way, where we've had people in that neighbourhood complain about some of the Aboriginal parents waiting at the bus stop, who parents have been questioned while waiting for the kids at the bus stop.
What made me really sad with them kids last night is, you know, if you got into trouble, would you call the police? The answer's no, because of that situation of, you know, we've got all these police at them, manhandling my mother coming down the steps of a house, or, you know, all the presence in Inala or wherever people come from, that's a real issue, and that's something that them kids will have to live through for the rest of their life, you know, which is really sad. And like you said, it starts from a really young age.
And we encounter police at a very young age, and not even in the act of committing a crime.
No.
Just going about our business, being asked, who are you? What's your address?
What's your address? What are you doing? My brother the other day came home from the shops, had a bag in his hand. Where'd you get that from?
Yep.
Oh, well, I bought it. Show me the receipt. You know, that's just things people go, oh, that doesn't happen. Oh, it does.
Yeah. It's never in a way like, oh, hi, how you going? Who are you? Mm-mm. Who's your mob? No. Different. Yeah.
Yeah.
Different.
Some of the responses, though, from Struggle Street. What did you pull out? Because I no longer have Twitter. Let me just say, me and Twitter.
How come? You don't like
Okay,
Twitter?
I did have Twitter a few years ago, and someone hated me so much that they made a profile about me and pretended to be me and, like, completely just went overboard.
No.
Yeah, I was just minding my own business. I was driving home from work, and then my friend rang me and said, I think someone's like created a profile to have a go. And I was like, can't be.
You did one of them blue tick ones.
True, honest. I was like, hey, I must be that deadly, eh? People making these fake profiles now,
yeah,
running me down.
Yeah, we all got our fans. They're working hard without you even knowing it.
They work. And also Snoop Dogg retweeted me once, and I had to just shut my page down because it just went too crazy.
That's next level. What did he retweet you on?
He was in Australia, and so he did a hashtag went in Australia, and so I put, along with everyone else's, you know, people put, oh, have a barbecue, go to Bondi Beach, blah, blah, blah. I put, went in Australia, acknowledge and pay respects to the First Nations people, the Indigenous people. And then I think I said something like, you know, welcome to Australia or something like that. Snoop Dogg retweeted
it.
Hey, Snoop Dogg, my brother. And then next minute, being called all the this and that under the sun, to the point my phone was just buzzing like every half a second. I had to shut my whole page down. So thanks there, Snoop.
Well, so people were wild at you because he retweeted you.
And, yeah, next minute racist and all this. Oh, it was crazy.
Oh, goodness.
But also it brings up my blood pressure because of things like Struggle Street and the people that jump on there.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the show's is powerful. It's necessary. People, and unfortunately, it's necessary because people are so far. The income inequality is so wide that people have no idea that this is the world we live in.
Pretend it doesn't exist.
Pretend it doesn't exist, and we just think we can blame people for their predicament and that, you know, ignore the structural factors that create these conditions. But so I watched it on Twitter, and that's when it's just like, it's just really not. You know what I realize is that white people are nasty to themselves, not just to black fellas.
No.
Maybe that's why they say they're not racist, because they're just mean to everyone.
They're mean to everyone. I'll call everyone a bludger mate, you know? It just, if I can do that, then it makes sense.
Just heartless stuff. I'm just, I
saw one that, you know, there's one person that said, having a crap childhood, bullied as a kid but as a teenager, gainfully employed, lost my job in my early 20s and Centrelink for 2 months, then redundant in mid-30s and then gainfully employed. I choose not to be a victim. I choose to get on with it. That's a high horse thing of like, oh, you know, I've been there, I've done that. Like, just get on with it. What, if I can do it, why can't you? I commend you. Yeah, that's great. You know, you've gotten out of the struggle. But yeah. I'm sure you probably don't have as many issues as half of these people have, you know, which stem from a long time ago. You know, like.
But even the myth about choice that,
yes.
you know, mental illness, drug addiction is a choice.
Is a choice yeah.
What kid do you meet? You say, what you going to be when you grow up? And they're going to go, I'm going to be homeless with drug addiction and mental illness and be on Centrelink all my life. No one says that. No one chooses that.
No. And it's really hard to get out of that cycle.
Absolutely.
You know, I've always, you know, I've been on AB study, I've been on New Start, I had to be on those things. CDP got me out in the end, can you believe it? But, you know, I've been on that struggle where you're wanting to get ahead, you're really wanting to, but you don't even have enough and the system is there to kind of keep you down. You know, you get so far up and then they take your money or they'll cut you for this or they'll cut you for that. Like my brother came home about a month ago and said, I just quit Centrelink. I said, how do you quit Centrelink, bruh? This black kid, Erica, nah. I'm getting mucked around by them job services mob too much. They just make me sick. You know, they're running me around because
that you know, job service settling stuff, it creates mental illness.
It creates mental. This fella will come home at 9 a.m. smashing up my house because while it's someone's like, hey, chill out.
They sit there for hours. They get stuffed around. Then the emails and you've got to log in. It is a nightmare.
It's a nightmare.
And it makes a whole lot of presumptions about people's capabilities.
That's it.
They have a phone.
Yep.
They have a fixed address.
Internet. Credit.
That they have the social skills to be able to navigate all these various processes and mechanisms. And, you know, a lot of these job services are getting paid a lot of money deal with the business of unemployment. But how effective they are in getting our mob jobs.
And not just
another
jobs.
Thing.
They don't encourage careers and they don't encourage dreams. Now, my brother has a dream to be a dancer. So he's just auditioned for a certain place here in Brisbane. So he wants to do that. And that if he gets in, he'll be doing that next year. So at the moment, he's working part-time. And he said, I don't want to commit to a full-time job because that's what I want to do next year. And I don't want to tell an employee, hey, listen, I'm going to quit this full-time job because this is actually what I want to do.
Yeah, muck him around kind of thing.
Muck him around. So he's trying to do the right thing. But then you got the job agencies like, well, no, you've got to, like, do this. You know, it's like, what about your dream? Like, have you ever told someone, no, you can't do your dream so you can just go and work some...
I think because they're not living their dream.
Exactly. They ain't living their dreams. So some of us got dreams, you know. It's hard, but it does create, you know, a huge, big amount of stress on people. And this whole thing of choosing to be in poverty, it's just, it's not a thing.
And the way in which poverty compounds the effects of, like, say, mental illness and addiction, you know, because this is not
it.
Mental illness and addiction is not something that is means tested that only poor people experience. But if you have those things and are poor, then it has a whole nother effect than say if you have intergenerational wealth and privilege, that you have two parents, that you have a will from, you know, inherited wealth, that you'll have these things to fall back on or protect you.
Yeah.
If you have none of that, then the struggle is proper real.
It's proper real. And you're so vulnerable. You know, I had to raise my brother as a single parent and I was getting single parenting payments, not something that I wanted to do, but I couldn't work.
You didn't choose that.
I didn't choose it. You know, I couldn't get work or wanted to do the things I wanted to do because I have a 13-year-old that I have to raise that can't be at home on his own or that is having troubles at school or, you know, I've got to come home. There's so many things that people have to do, but you're barely making the rent. You're barely putting food on the table. And that's not a joke. Like, it is real to the point when you're like, oh, I think I'm going to be homeless. We're going to have to split up. At some point in my life, I was like, okay, I'm not making enough. I'm going to have to, like, get my brother to live with, like, an auntie and I'm going to have to just go. And, like, these are thoughts that have actually gone in my head.
Hey, yeah.
Like, I saw Auntie Norma there last night, you know, on saying I had to split my family up. Like, I know that's struggling, you know, like a lot of our mob do.
Absolutely.
So it's real. It's real.
We're at QuadCiv graduation this year and there was a young girl from Woodridge High who finished grade 12, but she lost her mother in the middle of grade 12. And had to live independently and do all that, you know, and people have no idea. We hear about Indigenous health inequality.
Yeah.
But the lived impact upon that, upon our mob that is left behind.
my mum passed at 49 years old. When we talk about closing the gap, I'm a living, breathing statistic of that because I got left behind. My brother got left behind. I was 25 when I started raising him. He was 13. Mm. So, you know, this stuff really, really exists. It's not a joke. It's not something that we're, like, exaggerating. It's lived experience, you know. So then when you get tweets like, you know, why is family planning so hard for people on Struggle Street? Everyone has 4+ kids trying to have empathy and compassion, but the adults involved making it hard. It's like, think about the things behind all of this. Mm-hmm. You know, like, there's so much more than just the, oh, well, they just keep having kids. Why do they keep having kids? Absolutely. You know, like, yeah.
You've just tuned in. This is 98.9 FM. This is Let's Talk, and we're talking Struggle Street.
The wick on the candle disappears. Melted wax reminds of rubber years. Our loneliness reappears, does anybody see? She waits for you, she waits for me. Empty seats longing to be filled. She says, time enough now to do it me. She says, I remember strength. I remember love. It kept me from drowning. I remember time. A cheerful smile greets me when I look at her. Knowing her pride and soul alive. The day will come for us to part. She's been the strongest from the start. And when she looks to me, I'll be there. I tell her I'll be there.
Glaucoma is a common form of eye disease that often runs in families. It affects the optic nerve connecting the eyes to the brain. The most common form of glaucoma begins with the loss of side vision, which is also known as peripheral vision. There's no pain or discomfort associated with glaucoma, so it's common people are left unaware of damage glaucoma causes, and sadly, it can lead to blindness if undetected. Those most at risk of glaucoma include people who have a family history of glaucoma, are aged 40 years and over, people who are short-sighted, and people who have diabetes. To ensure your vision is as clear as possible and to prevent any vision-related issues, it's recommended that people should have their eyes examined by an optometrist once every 2 years. Check out the Bima Project's website for more informative messages at bima.projects.org.au.
A message from the Staying Strong Project, funded by the Australian Government Department of Health.
This is Chelsea Bond with Let's Talk.
This is Chelsea Bond with Let's Talk Live, and I've got my sister here, CJ from CJ's Vines.
Morning.
Morning. We're talking Struggle Street, but before we continue our yarn, I just looked on Facebook and I noticed that there is a deadly uncle whose birthday is today.
Shout out time.
Uncle Vern Hopkins is going to wish you happy birthday. He's a long time listener. I think he's going to come into the station in a couple of weeks' time and have a yarn with us, so I hope you have a really deadly day, Uncle Vern. Just for you, Uncle.
Happy birthday, Uncle.
He'll be long living on Struggle Street out of Nala. So, and we've been talking a little bit about that, and about the response to the show more broadly, about what it does. Do these shows inspire? Well, they're necessary stories, important stories. Does it inspire change? And
I don't know. Hey, I watch it and I see the people. They're like, when you've gone through the lowest of the low and you're sitting on Struggle Street and you're just like, every day is a struggle, you know, every single day. There's a certain resilience that comes out of that, and I feel those people are so powerful. Like, they just have so much power that is just so untapped, you know, like that they are capable of anything, you know, like Auntie Norma said last night, you know, we just hustle, we just get it done. You just got to keep moving forward, you know.
And so this was on the point after the screening, and she the show ended with a really, I think, powerful statement from Norma about, you know, and she said, I don't want pity, I want some understanding, have a heart, which is, looking at Twitter, some people are heartless. And you mentioned earlier about Chris Sara, his commentary, and I thought it was really interesting. What he did, I thought, was really interesting, really good. He guided the viewer of a way to think about the story.
Yeah, his view was so different to the rest of the panel in a way of he would speak to the people sitting on the couch, not about them, I thought.
Yeah, he did. He's straight to her.
And straight to her children. And
that's being human.
Yeah, and thought, you know, this is the real person. She's sitting right here. I'll just talk to
her. Yeah, I can't talk about her.
And I felt sometimes, the others kind of talked around, or like talked about the issue or about the family, you know, for their own reasons, obviously, which, I really loved Dr. Chris Sara's responses. It was much more human and encouraging for them, I felt.
And he pulled out moments. He said, look, see when she just touched her daughter? That shows her love for her. See, when this happened, this showed this. And so what he was reminding the viewers that in amongst the crisis moments, we see the strengths of our mob.
Yeah.
And we have to remind ourselves of that, because so often we are told of our incapabilities, what we're lacking, what we need fixing, you know, how to improve ourselves, because we're this constant state of, in need of improvement. And he made sure that when he spoke, he spoke to and validated both the struggle and the strengths.
Yeah, and I think a lot with our mob as well, and it's something that runs in every Blackfellow family that I know, especially my own, is you may not always have a lot growing up, but you always have each other, and you always have that love. You know, sometimes that hate, because you're growling every now and then, let's be real, you know, like family is like, oh. But at the same time, at the end of the day, after all that's done, there's always that love between mob, you know, and I think that's what got them particularly through. Where compared to a lot of, you know, the other mob who were really alone, you know, on Struggle Street, a lot of them had, like, you know, brother boy there with the dogs, and he's, you know, living on his own, and his family hate him. Like, that stuff there, like, really made me sorry, you know, not to compare people or to compare situations, but, you know, like, I'm really grateful, you know, to be part of Blackfella culture and to be a Blackfella, because, you know, you always got that mob there, you know, to fall back on.
And we saw that last night in the last two episodes of mob being there and advocating for, standing up for, you know. So it's an interesting observation, because those stories did sit differently when you think about that as well. I wrote an op-ed piece for The Guardian. So I'm on the board of a community organisation called Anala Wongra, and we have had the good fortune of hosting Indigenous X on Twitter this week, just to also show some of the work that you know, the community,
the positive stuff that happens,
and kind of showing the community, while there's a national audience, what's happening in the community every day. And because I mean, that the structural disadvantage to experience that interpersonal level, but also experience at an organisational level. You know, we've got two organisations in an Isle of Indigenous organisations that are effectively homeless, that don't have a place to operate out of, while we have all these big government and church-run institutions who have purpose-built buildings in our community. And so there is this disadvantage is a real thing. But so I wrote a piece for The Guardian because it comes with the Indigenous X hosting thing. And then fellas changed the title of my article.
You was raging straight away.
I was like, that's not the title I used. That was just one line, and that doesn't reflect the actual article itself.
Yeah. And that's usually, that's the first thing that people see online, you know. Online communities, that's the first thing you read.
They read the headline and they comment.
They're too lazy to read the half the thing half the time.
So it's a bit, normally when you do these, they write these op-ed pieces, if they make changes, because the editors, it goes to an editor, they play with it and whatever. Normally they come back and show you the changes, but I didn't, this first time I've written for These Mob, and it didn't, I got to see the final when it was actually published. And so the question that the title they end up using was a question about media representation. And I kind of spent the first two paragraphs in this article saying it actually is not, this is, my conversation is not about media representation. So, but looking at the kind of utility of these kinds of stories, what it serves, and that, yeah, you don't have to go to Inala or Woodridge to see Struggle Street in terms of for blackfellas. You just got to look at Indigenous affairs right now in this country.
Everything, yeah.
You know, that the Prime Minister can dismiss the Uluru Statement out of hand, and there's no protests and marches and no ministers tying themselves to Kirribilli House. There's not
Black
a whimper.
Kids can get killed in custody.
Not a whimper.
Get run over.
Keep the cameras rolling in Indigenous affairs, and we can see Struggle Street every day. It doesn't matter what suburb you're actually in. And so it was a bigger story. And, you know, like, and then, so then NITV have put out an article this morning kind of having a little go at me saying that, you know, we can have stories where people can laugh and cry. I'm like, well, that wasn't my argument.
Yeah.
Can you not read?
What was your argument? Tell us.
My argument is colonization's brutal.
Yes, it is.
And that it's everywhere.
Yes.
It's everywhere. And that these stories, of course, they have to be told. But the other thing is that had it not been for Late Line's expose on the trauma of Aboriginal communities in Northern Territory, where they fabricated some stuff as well, it's on the record, it was only through that armies were able to roll into our communities. It was only because of those stories that it made it possible for them to take over the leases and permit system and all of that. Yeah. Those stories serve a purpose.
Yeah.
And, yes, they have a value for us sometimes when we share our stories and get validation from them. They work for us, but they're always working on us in the colonial project. Always.
I started...
It's not about good or bad stories. Colonization, a bit more complex than that.
I started my media career in radio when I was 19 because I was so, even then, you know, that was like however many years ago now. I'm still young, but, you know, look.
I'm going to say, Nana.
A joke. Come, Nana, auntie, make me a cup of tea there, bub. Nah.
I'm going to do a Savic, never mind.
But, you know, I started that because, and because I love music and I love talking, you know, it was really fun and entertaining, but then, being in blackfella media, you really quickly get to learn that you're in this to change things. You're in here to have a voice because we don't have a voice out there. So what I do with CJ's Vines is my voice. You know, I know it's a lot of voices for a lot of other mob as well. I don't represent that. You know, I represent myself when I'm doing these stupid things because no one's as doogie as me.
Hey,
but, you know, that's our voice because the media is so up against us with the way they portray us, with images, with sound, with like everything to do with media. You know, it's really, really frustrating. And I've broken into mainstream media and I've been able to put some really positive stories out. That's something I'm really proud of and that I push all the time. You know, I've got contacts in mainstream that I do that with all the time. But majority of the time, let's be real, when that story comes out, it's always that negative story because that's what sells. I had a very prominent mainstream broadcaster tell me that once before. So I know that for a fact.
Hopefully things are going to get brighter.
Oh,
Chelsea Bond with Let's Talk.
This is Chelsea Bond with the remix, Christina, new version of Ooh Child. We thought it was the old one, the original one.
Love a good remix.
Hey.
Good remake.
If you've just tuned in, I'm talking with my sister, CJ.
Hello.
From CJ's Vines, and we've been talking about Struggle Street and the talk about Struggle Street over the last few days. Which has kind of got us thinking about the Indigenous reporting on Indigenous affairs,
which is just a big sigh. You know, I get really, really, this is something I'm really passionate about, is when I see these negative headlines and newspapers, and it is a lot of the newspapers that do it. Of course, our news stations and whatever else, mainstream stations, they don't cover a lot of Indigenous topics or headlines, but when they do, it's usually, you know, negative. And then when you do see a positive one, you're like, oh, shock, horror. Like, what's going on? You know, it's a real shock, because I've seen, and I've worked in media, like I said, and you work so hard. You know, we all work so hard on the ground, whether we're doing something for our families or in work. You know, there's so many people that are doing good things in our communities that never get talked about.
And, you know, I don't think the good stories that tend to get up are the exception role model stories.
Yeah.
And so there's like you know, a good 100,000 exceptional Aborigines who are role models for the people, instead of being reflective of the capabilities of our people. And so what we tend to get is not the good stories about the collective good of mob, or when we're united and doing things like, you know, good community programs, or
just even everyday things. That's what makes
just like them slack, other like, fellas get the good news stories.
Exactly, good news stories. It's really not that hard, and there's so many out there. Like, if they just ask somebody, you know, what's a good positive story that we can cover in the news? I'm sure any black fella would know something that's deadly that's happening, you know?
I still remember, I think it was Invasion Day last year, and biggest mob marching and all that kind of stuff. And we go home, watch the Channel 10 news, where they're filming in South Bank the Australia Day celebrations, right? And not one black person's featured on this story. But, like, you know, a few thousand people had walked past them. Like, the lengths they go to ignore. It's Come not on. That this, they can't find the stories. It's not a mystery. No. There is a conscious, deliberate ignoring of
decisions, yeah. Choosing to ignore, you know, black fellas.
They would have had to cut through the protest traffic to get to that, to be able to film the story. But they went, oh, quick, cameras off. We don't want to capture black fellas being exactly. united.
Yeah. I was in Canberra the other day, my first time saying I've been to the tent embassy, and it was raining, so I couldn't get out. But we drove down there, and I went, this is my first time here. Look how close it is to Parliament House. And they just pretend that these black fellas aren't here every day. Every day they cruise past this. Oh, what's this? Oh, it's a camp that's been here for how many years? You know, like they
well,
just.
Well, it's kind of reflective of a little something, hey?
It's just crazy.
How could they not see us here already?
And if we don't laugh, we cry. You know what I mean? Because you see, you work your butt off in community or your own home or wherever. And then you see these headlines come up and it just reinforces these stupid negative stereotypes for people to just feed off.
Oh, well,
you know, I told you so.
And even 17-year-old little kids who have never even done anything in Indigenous affairs.
Or in their life
are writing op-ed pieces that are getting circulated. Wow. So this, and he's Caleb Bond, no relation.
Hey,
Bond,
that's
no
your
relation.
More, you're more blah.
Not even. And he's written this op-ed piece that got circulated. This is a little while back now. And he's making all these claims, no references except to a 2003 study about, you know, and the headline is Stopping Aboriginal Violence is a Conversation We Must Have as Australians.
Oh,
as if he owns the right to tell us what.
Who are you?
Who are That's, you? Who's your mob?
Who's your mob? Chelsea Bond. No, look. You know what? Even Pauline Hanson this week used the same sex. You know, vote to demonise black fellas and say
that, auntie.
Oh, we get free lunches. Why don't we get no free lunch at school? I wish we got free lunch. Wouldn't have to have stinking sugar on bread. No, don't. You know, but and it's just crazy.
And, you know, and I know that you called out publicly recently, you know, tragically we've lost some young people up in Townsville and the irresponsible reporting on that from the Townsville Bulletin with
Townsville bullying.
Even in moments of crisis, there's still no sense of respect of nothing is sacred in terms of our trauma and the way in which they use it.
Yeah. You know, there was a recent article, it was an opinion piece that was published.
There are always opinion pieces reporting on Indigenous affairs.
And that's fine, but have a counter argument is my argument.
Or some
you know
black
what I mean?
Arguments.
It's some black arguments, which is the counter argument. You know, there are a lot of people out here that write articles. There's one sitting across the desk from me, but you don't hear that voice. Instead, we see a picture of, you know, an Indigenous girl sitting in the gutter, chroming, and, you know, after two Indigenous kids up there have tragically passed away.
Mm.
You know, where is the humanity in that? There is a responsibility as media to report fairly, you know. That's across the board. So it's just the human aspect that's missing that I just can't understand, and it really upsets mob, you know. I just can't.
Not even just sympathy for the family, concern,
no sensitivity,
nothing.
No responsibility of thinking, maybe you shouldn't show this because what if others go and do it? You know, like there's no thinking, no thought process happening.
No, and anything that happens to an Indigenous person is reflective then of all Indigenous people and then is an indictment on how bad Indigenous affairs are. And
especially in that community, I know Townsville, you know, that community's had a really rough time in the past year and a lot of kids up there being stereotyped for crime and for all these types of abuses. So you're further demonising all these kids in the community who already have community hating on them as it is. So what are you doing for that situation? You know, it's okay to report about it. It's okay to do these things. But what are you actually doing, you know, and how are you helping this situation? I think that's just something that people should take in mind when they're reporting about things like that.
Absolutely. I mean, if I've read one article about Indigenous, you know, problems or issues, I've read them all. You know, there's a formula, there's a certain kind of stock images that they use. You know, our kids are used as props in all kinds of ways for any kind of story. I've had an experience myself, my own kid.
Archive pitch. You know, like when I'm going to go write a story about, I've seen one in a local newspaper, or again in North Queensland, of homelessness in the city. They chose to use an Indigenous black man's image. Not that there's, you know, non-Indigenous people that are homeless in the city, but let's further stigmatise that and use that image instead. You know, it's just like, come on, you can choose to do these things, but you're not.
Absolutely. You know? And I guess the key issue here is not about, you know, good stories or bad stories of black people or white people. It's about getting at the complexity of the issue and not relying and trading off old stereotypes.
Archive pictures or just it's really lazy.
It is lazy. Yeah.
We can do better, Australia.
Hey, we need to do better. We're just about out of time. I want to thank you, CJ, for coming in for a yarn. We're watching Struggle Street over the next week as well. Much respects goes out to all our mob on Struggle Street. We know it's an everyday experience, and it's an everyday location. And this goes out to you, mob.
If you need a friend.